Hey, you're listening to the Victims and Villains podcast, a podcast dedicated to educating and engaging individuals like yourselves on mental health awareness and suicide prevention through pop culture. My name is Captain Nostalgia, and on this episode, we are diving into some life-changing stories and how mental health is affected in the long run from that. Please help me in welcoming to share her story. She is the head ghoul behind the ghoulish garb, Miss Shanna Stoker. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I am well. I'm very, very well. I'm excited to kind of expand upon this story because I love doing podcasts like this. We've kind of exchange a few emails back and forth, but I'm excited to finally sit down and talk about it because I believe stories like what we're going to be telling over the course of this podcast are important steps in order to deconstructing the stigma surrounding mental health, because it helps remind us that we're not alone.
Absolutely. And I'm really grateful to be a part of it, because I think that's definitely a conversation that more people are willing to have these days. And I think it's important that we do.
Well, before we get into talking about more of the personal side of your story, let's talk about the ghoulish garb for a few minutes. Tell us a little bit about this little company you run.
I would love to. So it's actually just my business partner, myself, that run the entire company. So it is a very small operation. We've been in business since 2018, and we focus on creating designs that are unique and that cater to both anybody interested in witchcraft, anybody interested in all things spooky. And we are best known for our Terror Tarot Major Arcana Collection. I can't even say it. But yeah, it's a tarot collection that is all based on spooky lore. So we're really proud of that. We're working on another deck right now that's focusing on goddesses and other female figures in witchcraft. And we've just released our Bartholomew plushie, which if you're able to see, I don't know if they'll be able to see, but that's behind me on the wall there. So yeah, we're really excited about releasing this next set of cards next year, hopefully, and then getting started on finishing up the Terra and making it a full deck, not just the minor arcana or major arcana.
I feel my wallet crying out to Bartholomew right now. I used to
so
have
cute.
He is adorable. I'm looking at him right now on Instagram. I used to have a bat that my wife got me that stuck right on this, and it actually broke. So I've been I've been looking for a replacement for like a year, but I have Nicolas Cage right here.
So, well, hey, if you can't have Bartholomew, then he's a good runner-up.
Wow, it's like quite a tongue twister with the Yeah, I can't even feel it. I feel like the T's don't want to come out to enunciate themselves. I've actually never had. It works. We started out with alliteration. Every one of our early episodes used to be Simon and Sam or something like that. It was really dumb. I am curious right now because we've never actually had anyone on the podcast in 400 episodes. We've never had anyone that specializes in anything like the tarot cards. Can you kind of talk about, I'm interested in kind of the process of how you guys create those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things to do with this business, honestly. We didn't even intend to create tarot when we got started with this. It was just going to be a t-shirt company. I had the idea that we should make our niche something to do with the occult, because that's what I'm interested in. So I knew that would be something I would really enjoy creating new designs for. And that was where the idea originally came from. But then our very first tarot design that we created was, it was the goddess Freya in Fortune. And it was this still one of our most popular designs, even though it's completely different than the rest of our designs. But it's kind of Art Nouveau. And even though we loved that, I wanted to go more of a medieval woodcut way. And so I found this artist, because I, as much as I have all these pictures in my head, I cannot actually execute them. So we use a, we use an artist that we hire in, and he's fantastic. I absolutely love working with him. And, but I found him, and we've just ever since, like, we've even worked to get our, I guess, our own style within his like medieval woodcut style. And now we have the Ghoulish Garbs version of that. So absolutely love that. But basically, to do every single design, it starts off where we have an idea of what we want every single card to be already, because we want the overall picture before we design each card individually. We want to know where everything's going, right? Because tarot is a story. If you look at the cards, especially in the major arcana and in within each suit of the minor arcana, each set basically has a story. And the story of the major arcana is kind of the journey of the Fool, who is in our set, he's the second card, or the first card, excuse me, zero. And so what we decided was we wanted this to all be very spooky. And so we knew we wanted archetypes for each individual card. And we went behind and decided, like, let's make a huge list of all of the attributes of the card in tarot, like the Rider Smith Waite original tarot. What does this card mean? And then which archetype can we mesh into that storyline and into those principles of that card? So for example, of course, very popular, we have Karen as the Hermit. So what that is the ferryman on River Styx, essentially. So he's the psychopomp leading you, you know, into the afterlife. And that's the Hermit. He, and there's these like hands from the River Styx coming out of the water at him. It's super creepy, but it gets the same idea across of, you know, kind of being in a place of understanding your higher self a little bit more, a place of solitude, place of wisdom. And that's one of our absolute favorites, but it takes, it can take total of like 20 hours just to design. So from the back end, just to figure out what we want the card to look like. Then we send that to our artist. He gives us a sketch. We revise the sketch. He sends us another sketch. We revise that. He sends us the color. We revise that. So it takes like a month just to do one individual card, which is why it's so exciting and daunting to think about doing the minor arcana.
I couldn't even imagine like sending off a podcast and like waiting a month for like one single, like one, especially if you're doing like a series, like the true crime podcast, like they sound so great, but I imagine that they take like 3 to 4 weeks a piece to do something like that. I commend you for your guys's patience, because I'm just kind of scrolling through your Instagram feed. It's like, you guys definitely have a really unique style, and it kind of almost has this, I don't want to like compare, but it reminds me of Shudder acquired a documentary. It's like the bee's knees. If you like full core, this is the documentary to watch, but it's called Woodland Days, and I can't remember. It's a really long title. But like the poster art for that film just absolutely just looks a lot like the kind of style and like the artistry that you guys have. I really like the folkiness, the and the vibes to it. I actually also sent my wife some of the while you were talking, so she's like texting me about it. She's like, these look so cool.
That's awesome. This is actually one of our designs behind me. This is the Lovers in black and white. So that's from our, we did the tarot deck, and we have it all in color, of course. And then we decided to do the shadow edition in black and white for people who like more of a minimalist style. And so like all of our art can be found in both color and black and white on our t-shirts and tapestries and stickers and everything. So I like that because it opens it up to a different audience.
Well, before we get too carried away with talking about all these wonderful things, where can people find and peruse the designs that you guys currently have?
I would recommend either going on Etsy and just searching all one word, the Ghoulish Garb, or you can go to Linktree and Linktree, the Ghoulish Garb, because that's where you'll find all of our links, for Etsy, eBay, Amazon, Society6, Redbubble, social media, my links. So that's all going to be probably the best way to go. And that's going to be, I don't know if you can link it somewhere because the linktree/theghoulishgarb.
Oh, well, listeners, click the link in the show notes below. It'll get you all of the fun stuff that you guys can check out, and it'll help you brighten your spirits after such a heavy episode. But these are important topics that we feel like we need to address, and we're going to take it back a little bit. So I found you on TikTok. I came across it, and it was just kind of randomly after your page one day. And you talked about this day that really changed your life forever, and getting to hear a little bit about it. Can you kind of talk about where a lot of the, the day that Shanna changed forever?
Sure, I guess it's like the kind of from the top.
let's just jump into it from the top. Yeah.
All right. So I recently made a series about this on TikTok, and it was because, you know, I've gotten the chance to do a lot of media interviews like this, and I'm so grateful. And every time I get asked to do one, I notice that, of course, they're doing their due diligence and doing their research and looking up, you know, my social media posts. And so this gets asked a lot because I typically make one post a year about it. And I made a few posts, of course, the first year that after it happened. But basically, in 2018, June 3rd, 2018, I was in a really bad car accident. So out of nowhere, I was driving down the interstate on my way from Nashville to Mobile, Alabama, where I'm from. And I don't know how, but I lost consciousness while driving. And so they said that I was going, just based on impact, that I was going about 80 miles per hour towards stop traffic. And luckily, somebody saw me and honked their horn. And when they honked their horn, I remember waking up to the horn. And I woke up just in time to see the back of the semi truck. I remember screaming and turning the wheel to the right and blacking out. Well, what happened when I turned the wheel to the right, luckily I was on the right side of like the far right lane. So it was towards the shoulder. So I turned the wheel to the right and my car, of course, hooked to the right. The front left side of my car hit the back right side of the semi. Okay. You with me? That's a lot. So when the front of my car hit the back of the semi truck, the impact threw me over the inside console to the right of me. And I'm very lucky that it did because my car went underneath the semi and you can see where the corner of the truck actually went through my arm and the seat from where I was. So exactly when I was thrown over the center console is when my body made impact with the back of the trailer, I suppose. And so the corner of it that had I not been thrown would have gone directly through my chest. It instead went through my arm. So I woke up to the sky because the top of my car was 100 meters away or 100 yards away. Same thing, right? And so I just remember waking up and it was blue sky. It was a beautiful day. And I felt something wet spraying me. And I thought it must be like the fluids from the car. But then I realized it was my blood. And I looked down and like my left arm just was obliterated. It was just obliterated. It was awful. So I passed out at that point. And I was told later that was the moment that I died of blood loss. So I was dead for 11 minutes. And during that time, I distinctly remember what I experienced. So do you have any questions thus far? You want me to keep going?
You actually started at the second event, because you had talked about, I know originally when I reached out, you talked about, losing someone at 13. Mm,
that's right.
I don't want to, like, I didn't want to interrupt your story and be like, oh, she jumped ahead of the curve. No, it's fine.
Sorry, that one's been on the brain lately.
Yeah, you're fine. So when you were 13, you also kind of just backtrack a few years.
Yeah.
You also had said that, you essentially had a friend that had died after a accident. I don't know if it was accidental or not, but
it was an accident.
A BB gun went off and shot her in the temple, and to witness something like that at such a young age, that has to take its toll on you. So it's like, even like hearing now that like you've kind of gone into the world of like something like a horror aesthetic is very shocking to me, because I know that like there are other people that have had very similar instances happen to them, and they don't want anything to do with the horror community because it's too much of a trigger.
Yeah, and I think that's, I understand that. But for me, okay, so my whole life, I mean, ever since I was born, I've had a natural affinity towards spooky things. You can say it's in my blood. but I've always derived comfort from things that seemed to make other people less comfortable. And I don't know why that is, but that's just always been something that's been a part of me. And I've always been interested and had just a very morbid curiosity about death and about life and about, I grew up in the church, so I was aware and critically thinking about what does the afterlife mean, and is there an afterlife, and what does this mean for me? And so I've always been thinking of those things. And so, but when my friend Amber passed away when I was 13, I remember, it's hard to explain. I remember the thought that I had when we were on the way to the hospital, and I knew I'd been picked up early from school. I had been crying, of course, because I knew what that meant. And my mom took me back to my house to get a change of clothes so that we could meet my friends and her family at the hospital where they were going to pull the plug because she was brain dead. And I remember we were passing by this beautiful cemetery that's near my house, my house where I grew up. My papa is buried there now. And we went by the cemetery, and it turns out that was actually going to be the cemetery that Amber is buried in too, but I didn't know that at the time. And there's these gorgeous oak trees in Mobile where I'm from, and they hang over the streets. And they're one of my very favorite things about living there. It feels like it's just that Southern romantic, almost Southern Gothic. It's gorgeous. And we were passing by the cemetery under the trees, and I remember thinking, Amber's never going to see trees again. And that right there was, for some reason, like the sentence that I clung to when I was trying to understand my grief. And it was because of this idea that she was literally no longer going to ever have a chance to experience what it was like to be in this world again. And what would that mean for me, that one day, was I never going to be able to experience the beauty of Earth again? Was I never going to be able to experience all of these things, that I was yet to experience? I was only 13. And I was just so sad, because I could see all of me, like my friends and myself, growing up and getting older and having kids and or doing whatever it was that we were going to be doing. And she wouldn't be there. She'd be forever 13. And I just felt so, I don't know, I just started thinking about it even more and even more, how does this pertain to me? And understanding at such a young age, having an existential crisis at a young age, and understanding my own, I'm only gonna, temporariness, I suppose.
Well, sure. Like even like, you know, from someone else that's also grew up in the church, it's the afterlife is something that we talk about and we simplify so regularly. It's like, well, if you accept Jesus, you go to heaven. If you don't, mm-hmm. you go to hell. And, you know, it's okay. That's like, that's very all good and clear. But like, I feel like in that instance, when you're faced with something like that, you are at your own time now. You're like, oh man, like I am questioning my own morality.
Absolutely. And for me, I think that's where, you know, bringing it back to your question about where does that lead to me in spookiness, and my entire life is, you know, surrounded by the occult and macabre now, and I couldn't be happier. And why is that? I think for me, because there's also this disconnect when people meet me, they're like, you're so bubbly. I didn't expect you to be so bubbly. I would never have expected after meeting you for you to be the ghoulish gal. And I've had to reconcile that as well, because I am this very bright, bubbly person, an expressive person, but that doesn't mean, like, that's why it's so important that I do embrace the darker side of things, because I wouldn't be me without both sides. And it is by my macabre interests and morbid curiosities that I have learned so much about myself and my power, my strength, my ability to overcome. And I think that's something that horror is for a lot of people. It's the final girl stories. It's monsters replacing real life demons, you know? And I think for me, that's where that connection happens, is I've got so many real life demons and have had so many experiences that cause grief and depression and all of these different mental health issues, that like to see a tangible or at least characteristic version of a demon or an evil of some sort, and to see someone conquering that and to see someone overcoming that is always, always fun. Plus, I also just really love camp. and you know, spooky camp is where it's at for me. But yeah, it's been a coping mechanism, and it's been a way for me to explore that side without getting too, I don't know, oddly, without getting too dark.
No, I think you need that. And like, it's interesting because I too, like, also understand the personification of being a walking enigma, because I'm still very much active in the church. And on the flip side, I'm also very active in the horror community. You know, we're Mark, one of the other writers here, and myself are head of our horror division. And so like for us, like horror is something that's like, it has meant a great deal to me. And it's been oddly soothing when it comes to my own mental health journey. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is it's very cathartic.
And it is. That's the perfect word.
I get a lot. I just made a TikTok about this not that long ago, but like my favorite movie of all time is Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. And everyone kind of like gives me weird eyes when I say that, but like it came at a very pivotal moment in my life where I also lost a friend. You know, I lost him to suicide, but it still had a heavy impact on me. And his suicide came just a couple weeks after that movie came on DVD. And I just remember watching it and just going through that grief journey with characters like Annie and Lori and Sheriff Brackett, and really being able to embrace those character journeys. And horror, on the flip side of that, you also have horror that is like you said, it's campy. You have you know, Frankenhooker and Elvira, and you know, some just truly great
Killer Clowns from Outer Space, one of my favorites.
Yes. It like, you know, you have an entire like subgenre, like Serial Mom's another great one that, like, you know, John Waters, you know, the trauma films, you know, you have this like,
yeah,
these, like,
yeah,
these movements of, you know, underground, and like horror is the one kind of genre that I feel like it can literally be anything for anyone.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so exciting and important. I was just able the other day to, host with Ruby Tuesday, who's a horror hostess. She was hosting, well, we hosted together. It's called Death Drop Gorgeous. And it was a low budget,
yes,
film, but you know this, right? You know the film, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, I have, my gosh, yeah. I was obsessed with it. But like, that shows you right there, like, horror is for everyone, any representation. And I don't like the argument that some people make that, like, you know, there's been the Tim Burton argument. I love Tim Burton, but there's been the what he said about supposedly Black people not fitting in, you know, into his aesthetic or something. And I'm like, okay, that's you. Yeah, no, horror is for everyone. Horror is for everyone.
Oh, absolutely. And for those of you guys that don't know, Death Drop Gorgeous is now streaming on Shudder. And
it's amazing. Please go watch it.
It is, I would describe it as Showgirls meets Scream.
Oh, yes. So, well, just with
lots of fun,
you know, original Hairspray type of feelings.
Throw some John Waters in there.
Yeah.
So, like, I know for me, like, you know, kind of coming back into the heavier side of the conversation, I know for me, like, when I was kind of faced with Adam's death, I know that for me it like hit in a way that was just like, oh crap, like, now I'm having to, you know, kind of face and think about the mortality for the first time. You know, I'd lost grandparents, I'd lost family members after that, but I feel like, you know, losing someone in like freak accidents like Amber, and then like also suicide like Adam, it makes you kind of see death in like a whole new way.
Especially and, when they're your friend, your contemporary, yeah, your peer, you know?
Yeah. And like, so I'm wondering, like, if you can kind of describe what you felt and kind of coming to grips with the, you know, the fact of never seeing her again. If you or someone you know is listening to this podcast right now and you're struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, we encourage you guys to please reach out. This is the heartbeat of why we do what we do. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and as of this recording, there are 132 suicides that take place each and every day on American soil. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope. That resource is going to be right in the description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this. There you'll find resources that include the National Suicide Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. You can also text HELP to 741-741. We also have a plethora of other resources, including churches, getting connected with counselors, LGBT resources like the Trevor Project, and also Veteran Hotline as well. Please, if you hear nothing else in the show, understand that you, yes, you listening to this right now, have value and worth. We get it. Suicide, depression, mental health, these are hard topics, and the stigma around them doesn't make it any easier. But please consider the resources right in the descriptions below, wherever you guys are listening, because, once again, you have value and you have worth. So please stay with us.
I went to a very dark place. I say dark. I'm so grateful and I'm very lucky that we had a group of friends, that it was just our little group that we always, you know, we're hanging out on weekends and go to each other's homes. And I'm lucky I had them and that we all had each other, because it helped me not feel so alone. But even still, I went to a different school as all of them. I had known them from elementary school. And so at this point, I was 2 years into a different school. And so there was a bit of loneliness there. And I think that was kind of the real beginning of my depression, even though I didn't get diagnosed until I was like 24. I think it really started then because of the introspection that I had to do that I wasn't necessarily equipped for at that point. And the adults in my life didn't know what to do. I mean, they didn't know I needed therapy. They didn't know I needed grief counseling. They didn't know those things. You know, I mean, they tried to give me grief counseling at my school at one point, and I just remember being really pissed off by that. I don't know why, but you know, you go through grief, and anger is a part of it. And I was just so mad that this person that had absolutely no idea or interest in my life ever before this moment was now trying to counsel me about losing my best friend. Like, who are you? And you have absolutely no idea what I'm going through. Like, I just remember being and understanding that I was irrationally mad, but also giving myself a pass for that. I remember that. I remember sitting in that office when she was handing me the tissue box. And this was a teacher I liked. I mean, she had been my teacher the previous year. Like, I liked this woman. I just knew, like, this isn't what I need right now. I don't know what I need right now, but this is not it. And so I just kind of went through the motions and went back to class and then called out sick the rest of the day because I couldn't even take it. But I don't know. I think it was just, I've always been a very introspective person. And to now add existentialism, mortality, the idea of what does happen? Will I ever see her again? You know, are my beliefs that were at the time deep within the church? Is this what I believe? If so, is she going to go to heaven? Like, you know, I mean, just all of these worries and thoughts and fears. And we would go every year to her grave for her birthday and all meet up and everything. And I just remember, like, it never went away. And it's still to this day, I miss her. And I can easily step back into the shoes of feeling like I was when I first got the call. And I just knew, I swear to God, I just knew. Like, we all did. It was the strangest thing, but we all knew. Even before they had to pull the plug, we knew that for some reason this was going to mean that she was gone. And I don't know. It's such a complex feeling to describe. So I'm sorry if I'm not doing a very good job of it.
No, it's again, like, having faced that myself, like, I know what you're describing, but the listeners might not. And it's like, it's kind of weird to describe. I feel like the best way to describe it is like, if you've ever like had to have like a part of your body like replaced, or like you've ever broken something, and like anytime like the wind gets cold or there's like a pressure change, like you feel that in that part of your body that's broken, there are certain like themes or like habits or movies, like songs, even days of the year that can remind you of that person. And it feels like those things are the wind, and it's kind of like you're feeling that brokenness all over again.
That is such a good way to put that. That's very true.
Yeah. I just want to put like, I wanted to like try and think of a way to kind of like describe it to the listeners that might not.
I appreciate that, because that is a really beautiful way to put that.
I also only know that because of my wife has broken stuff, and so she's described it to me over the years.
Oh, maybe.
I lost you for a second. We're good.
Okay.
So like, and also too, like when you're, so at this age, like, you know, in, I mean, I think any age under 16 really is like, it's hard to talk to your kids. Like there's just certain things that like you are hard to talk to your kids about: sex, death, and like taxes. I like would probably be like the three main ones that are like really hard to talk about. And not being a parent myself and never wanting kids, like my friend Chris writes an all ages comic book for kids, and the last issue of that comic talked about how to address the subject of death with kids. And like, it's, he talked about, like, he was telling me about when he did that, he went through all of this research on, you know, am I doing this right? Like, so he would talk to parents that had like had to have those talks with their kids and like grief counselors and stuff like that. And it's such a lengthy process because you, as a kid, you're already in such a, you're already in such a fragile state, but like with going through puberty and like the teenage years, especially like the early teenage years, everything feels so heightened. So it feels like, oh, like this person broke up with me. It's the end of the world. So to throw in the death of a friend really kind of had to just feel extra heavy on you.
So yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. It is heightened when you're that young, and it should be. Hopefully, these are the worst things that have happened to you when your boyfriend or girlfriend breaks up with you, when, you know, you don't win the big competition you've been trying to get behind or you've been working for. When anything like this happens, it's supposed to break your heart on monumental levels, because hopefully that's the most heartbreaking you've had to go through at this point, right? And so for me, I think being 13 and losing Amber the way that we did, it really made a lot of us mature earlier than we would have, not completely. Of course, we're still 13, 14-year-old kids, but to a point where those disappointments that did come had a lesser blow. They had perspective. We had perspective, I suppose. And it also caused me at such a young age to be fully aware of the little time we have on this earth and to do my best to live a life that made me happy and that I could be proud of. you know, and I think I am grateful for that lesson. I'm grateful for those changes in me and the ability that it gave for me to see things differently. Because I wouldn't be who I am today. I wouldn't have gone so wholeheartedly into my spiritual practice, which led me into witchcraft. I wouldn't, you know, there's just so many different facets of who I am today that would not have been the same if I didn't unfortunately have to go through that grief.
It's crazy how grief works that way, because I probably wouldn't be doing anything in the field of mental health. I also would never have met my wife, because I met her doing mental health advocacy work. Wow. And, you know, I wouldn't be where I'm even living today and, you know, working and have made the relationships that I have because of all of the, you know, just one single losing one single person, you know, it really can change your life in a multitude of ways. And, you know, I think as much as it sucks that, you know, you have to go through that season of grief for, you know, 6 months to 6 years to, you know, even 60 years, it will, it's all about how you respond to it. And if you respond positively to it, then you kind of go through these like avenues of, you know, it being, you know, in your case, you know, going through, you know, witchcraft and, you know, also opening up the ghoulish garb and everything else. And, you know, it has kind of led you through who you are now as an individual.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
you're fine. Let me make edit notes then. It's crazy to think about how grief works in that way, because, you know, I wouldn't know my wife if it wasn't for losing Adam. I wouldn't be in Richmond. I wouldn't have the community that I have. And also at the same time, like, I wouldn't be doing mental health advocacy work. I have never, if he would have talked to me when I was in high school, would I've been dreaming about doing podcasts, hosting a horror film festival, or doing conventions and just everything like this. Like I never would have kind of seen myself doing any of this stuff and talking about these heavy topics. And I can't imagine my life without these now. And so for you, kind of flip side, it sounds a lot like it's the same way for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was on the track to go into music performance. And I mean, I do perform and I'm grateful to have that as a part of my life, but I mean, opera performance and musical theater, like type of stuff. And I don't know. And then I got my degree in history. And so I thought I was going to be working in like museums, and it's just absolutely crazy how life throws curveballs at you. And I feel like you either have to make the most of it or fight against it. And I've finally stopped fighting against this part of me. That is such a big part of me. Like I said, it's always been a big part of me, and then losing her made it even more so. And so I think just allowing myself, it's a sense of peace, the catharsis, like you said, that you get from this, it offers a sense of peace when you're done. And I think it allows us to put a lot of those darker issues that we have personally dealt with, it allows us to put them in a box of entertainment in a way. And again, that's a coping mechanism.
Yeah. And so I'm really curious about something you had said a few minutes ago because I know for me that when I experienced this, like Adam's death was like, just like, it's such a, like it was a ground shaker. And like very similar to Amber's, I know that for me, I got more serious about my faith. And so like, I feel like I was just kind of going through the motions. And originally I'm curious kind of like where in your story, your timeline, you end up actually kind of, I guess, like going through the idea of going away from traditional church and kind of getting more into Wiccan.
So I wouldn't consider myself a Wiccan. That is, you know, something that is commonly misconstrued, which sure. is totally fine. I'm here to, you know, just help you out.
Educate me.
A little bit. Like, that's totally fine. It's a common misconception that if I call myself a witch, I must be a Wiccan. Now, Wicca is actually a religion, and witchcraft can be found within any religion. So there are witches I know who are atheist, and there are witches I know who are Christian and Jewish and who follow the Yoruba faith, and, you know, voodoo witches who follow more of a Catholicism based practice. And so there's witchcraft doesn't really have to do necessarily with your religion. It can, if you would like it to. It can work with your deities, whoever your deity might be, or multiple. Or I don't really work with deities. I believe in God. I don't really necessarily believe in portraying God as the capital he that I grew up with, just because for me, I think separating the God that I've always loved and always worshiped and always had a communication with and felt this connection to, separating it from the idea and the picture of God that is created by the church, for me, was important. And for others, that picture that is provided by the church is exactly what they get comfort from and derive power from. And I think that's beautiful. But for me personally, I tend to think of it more as a they, you know, and an entity rather than a being, if that makes any sense. It's kind of splitting hairs. But for me, that's kind of, I guess we call it the universe. So I just tend to use that terminology. When I say the universe, I mean this consciousness that I believe has helped life be, you know, become what it is today. But as far as my introduction into witchcraft and moving away from the traditional Christian faith, so I grew up kind of a part of two faiths because my parents were divorced when I was three. And so I spent a lot of my time visiting my dad in Auburn, Alabama. And we would go with my grandparents to the Pentecostal slash kind of Assembly of God church up there. So it was a lot of speaking in tongues and dancing and praise music. And you get into church and you kick off your shoes because you're going to be dancing or jumping up and down at some point. So it was that kind of place. And in Mobile, where I was living, I started going by myself because I think I just needed a social outlet. And they had a church bus that would come by my house. So I started going by myself to the local church, which was a Southern Baptist church. And so that was what that was the church that I went to by myself on my own because I needed to get out, because I liked spiritualism of you know, Christian sort at that point. And so I mainly belong to the Southern Baptist church. And so I don't know about you. You said you're from the South. So I don't know if you're Southern Baptist.
I am. I actually grew up Southern Baptist and then left. And then when my wife, probably about after Adam's death, I got into a non-denominational church. And then when I met my wife, we started going to a Pentecostal church. And nice. The two could not be further apart.
Exactly. They're totally different. Yes. So like I said, you've got the Pentecostal, which for me, or in Assembly of God, which for us and our church was lively and music based, which I absolutely adored because I've always been a musically inclined person. And I just remember I loved those services because it was fellowship and like just music and love and feeling the energy of the palpable energy in the air, you know, all these people who are just putting out energy for the same cause, for this worship of God and for this worship of, you know, what we call the word. Right. And so I just remember I loved that energy. And when I started going to Southern Baptist churches, again, I just started going there because it was all that was available to me where I was living. And I had youth groups in those areas and they were awesome youth groups. And I got to do some really cool stuff and meet some wonderful people whom I still love today. You know, it was a really big part of my growing up experience and who I am today as well. But I've always been a questioning person. And I will say those questions were not always met well. So for instance, when I was in third grade and I was learning in PACE about, we were learning about, you know, Greek mythology. And I remember learning about Pandora's box and thinking, this sounds a lot like Eve and Adam to me, or Eve specifically biting the apple and all of that, you know. And I remember asking my teacher what came first, which story, you know, the Greek mythology story of Pandora or the story of Adam and Eve. And so she was sharing, you know, Pandora came first. And so I took that to Sunday school and I'm asking my Sunday school teacher, can you tell me about this? Can you explain? Not because I was being obstinate, because I needed it to make sense to me. Like I needed what I've been told was absolute truth. Now in my third grade head was no more truth than the mythology that I was reading at school. And so I needed to know, like, and that was fine for me. It wasn't like, oh, this is it. I'm never going to believe. It was more of just like, oh, so what you're telling me is just like when I'm reading these mythology stories at school, I can take them for proverbs and are not, you know, literal proverbs, but for parables, and they're meant to teach us something, and fables. And that was the point behind them versus being told my whole life, no, this is like literally what happened, you know, and everybody has different views on what it was. But I just remember it wasn't their answer that put me off. It was that they didn't have an answer. And so they decided to tell me not to worry about it. And it was like time and time again that this happened at multiple churches with multiple adults that I was like, is anybody asking questions? And so whenever I got a little older and started talking about these things with my uncle, who was one of the only people that would talk about spirituality with me in a way that wasn't just, I don't know, and the pastor says this, and so this is what I'm going to tell you, so read your Bible. You know what I mean? And not in this just very kind of like, let me just answer you in a way that pushes your interest to the side to something else, but actually discusses what I wanted to talk about. My uncle was one of the only few adults that would do that with me. And so I found out through just talking with him and spending time with him that he had converted to Judaism around the time that I was like 14 or 15. And that's when he also told me that he's been practicing witchcraft for most of his life. And so I, who my whole life, any mention of a witch, I was just zoned in. I was always like, I don't know why, I always felt my whole life like I'm a witch. Of course I thought I was like a Sabrina witch, but it didn't matter. I was always just kind of, I felt like there was always something, like I just always was, witchcraft imagery was something from the age of a baby, according to my mother, that I've always been interested in. And I remember around this time too, was when I first saw a documentary on Wicca and on a practicing witch. And when I realized that witchcraft isn't just fantasy, you know, sparks flying out of people's fingers kind of stuff, there's actually a spiritualism and a practice of energy and nature and all of these things that I believe in, that I've always believed in, regardless of my Christian faith, that I've always believed that I could feel spirits around me in nature. And I've always been visited by paranormal entities. I've had that since I was a very young girl. And there was just a lot of stuff that, these questions that I had that I'm sure Christianity could have answered, but nobody was there to answer. Nobody really cared enough to try to help me out. You know, that opening myself up to other religious texts and to just spiritualism as a movement itself was where I found so much more peace. And it wasn't until, you know, it wasn't like as soon as this happened, I denounced Christianity. I didn't stop calling myself a Christian, even though it wasn't really part of my belief system. It was such a part of who I was. It was so hard for me to stop calling myself a Christian because I felt like I was going to disappoint people. And I didn't stop doing that until, honestly, a couple of years ago. It was probably around about the same time that I started this business, which was the same day that I had that accident where I died. And it's just, it's, that was like part two of me realizing you have to live in the moment and you have to be who you are and true to yourself and just try to be a good person and try to live a life that makes you proud and happy and, you know, try to do right by others. And like, that was just part two of that epiphany. So I think that was what I needed, the push I needed to decide that the label doesn't matter anyway for me. I personally don't think it matters. And I'm happier now that I don't have myself in a box. And that's not to say that if you want to tick off a box of a religion and that is what you prescribe to, for me, my box is witch. And so I, you know, I am still in a box, but my box is, has some walls that allow lots of movement and lots of things to be interchanged. So I like that.
Well, it also too, like, you know, kind of, at least also my experience, because I've also had a lot of the same experience that you've had with, you know, when you ask questions and you go to someone that is, you know, studying, has gone to school for this, or there is some sort of leadership role, you expect them to have the answer. And instead of saying, I don't know, because that's the thing about faith, is that faith is at it into to bring scripture into it. Like, it's like Jesus walking on the water, Peter saying, you know, if it's really you, tell me to come. And Peter stepping out in faith that he won't drown. He won't fall. That's essentially what, you know,
and that's a
faith
part,
in religion is. Yeah.
That's a big part of my witchcraft. If I didn't believe in my abilities to work with my own energies and the energies of those around me, or not those around me, but the energy around me and my space, if I didn't believe.
How would you guys like to help us get mental health resources into schools, conventions, and other events? Well, now you can. Simply go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains for as little as $1 a month. You guys can help us get mental health resources into current and upcoming generations, educate and break down stigma surrounding mental health, suicide, and depression. And you get exclusive content that you can't get anywhere else. And you guys can tell us which Nicolas Cage movie you want us to cover, and we'll do it. All it takes to get started is to go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains or simply click the link in the episode description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this episode. Pick your tier and get started today. Yes, it's that simple. So quickly select the tier that you want and help us get hope into the hands of the depressed and the suicidal today.
Then it wouldn't work, you know, and that's why I believe about witchcraft, I mean, about prayer and manifestation. So like in witchcraft, we use the term manifestation. You know, we also use prayer if you're praying to deities. But for me, I believe in the power of prayer because I believe it is simply people using their energies towards a common goal, or even just focusing your own energy on one goal. It's this idea that we ourselves have within us the same power of the universe that God created, right? And so like, that's the idea for me. And I have to have faith. I have to have faith that I am so much a part of the universe that I do have that within me, that we all have it within ourselves to take control and take our power back, essentially. And now whether you want to do that because of your faith in God and you believe that it's your faith in God that is causing the changes to happen, that are causing your blessings and your prayers to be granted, or if you believe it's, you know, the universe and simply you manifesting energies, whatever your reasoning may be, I believe it works. I think it does. And I think we can see that.
I'm just going to ask while we're on the topic of this, just a yes or a no. We don't have to get into it. How is the craft an accurate depiction of witchcraft?
No. No. Okay. I will say they all did right. Get a lot right. They got a lot right. But no, I wouldn't say so.
Okay. All right. It's one of my favorite movies of the 90s, and I just wanted to throw that there. All right. So getting back to the story, building this bridge from where we're at Amber's death at 13, to where we started with this accident and the inevitable death of yourself for 11 whopping minutes. You know, can you kind of talk about your battle through depression through this era of your life?
Yeah. So that was the darkest time of my life after this accident, because, all right, so I think I have to explain what happened in those 11 minutes in order to explain why the time after was so dark. Sure. So, like I said, they told me after the fact that I had been dead. And that finally made sense for what I had experienced. So in those 11 minutes, I passed out from blood loss and I died. And I remember waking up, or it felt like waking up. I didn't feel like waking up a grogginess. It just felt like a blink in my eyes were open, wake up kind of thing. And I was in this I've been calling it the void. But that's a scary term for a lot of people. So I don't mean it to be scary, but it was just, it was dark. It was black. It was nothingness. But it went on and on. I could tell there was a space to it. There was a sense of openness and just a space around me, but nothing, I wasn't tethered to anything. And what I mean by that is, even in a dream, I dream very vividly. So this is coming from just years and years and years of experiencing extremely vivid dreams and having extremely vivid memories of those dreams. And in all of my dreams, I feel a weight. I feel my body. I feel a sense that I have a body, right? There's that heaviness of like, why can't I run? Or I feel like everybody's experienced that at least once in their life, or, you know, maybe you actually fall and you get that feeling of that jolt or something. There's some sort of awareness of your physical form, even when you dream. And I distinctly remember that I felt so weightless, so completely weightless. And in this void, I wasn't touching anything. I didn't feel cold or heat. Some people have said they are asked that question, and I don't remember feeling that, but I do remember what I said to myself. So I kind of open my eyes in this void and I say these exact words. Well, shit. Sorry for the cursing. I usually don't, but I don't want to censor these words. So I said that, and I said, I think I just died. That sucks. I really liked that one. And this wasn't me thinking. This was a distinct memory of just words in my voice coming out. Like, it was like I was just floating thought, and I heard it almost within the space, but I knew it wasn't me saying words. So it was like a telepathic weird kind of projection of my voice. And I said those words, and I remember being like, that sucks. And then I said, I had this feeling of acceptance of like, there was this sadness because I was mourning the life that I had had, because I was excited to see what was going to happen with it. I was so excited. I could tell like what now I believe was my soul, was genuinely the way I describe it to people. Are you a gamer?
No.
Okay. But have you ever, well, I'll describe this and you may not understand, but I hope you will. Do you play D&D at all? Have you ever played D&D?
I don't. I have a lot of friends that play D&D, so like I understand the basics of it as well as gaming.
I'm going to put it in D&D terms because I do play, and I think like a lot of people will understand this. So in D&D, you take a lot of time typically preparing your character sheet, your backstory. You know your character inside and out if you play that way. There's not everybody does, but the people I know who play their characters, I mean, they spent years cultivating characters, cultivating, you know, their stats and their storyline and meeting new people and like, where have they gone? What have they done? What is their status in this world? I mean, like, they really put so much care and love and attention into these characters, and they live these lives, and they can go on for years and years and years. And then one day, all of a sudden, something happens in a campaign that you did not expect, and your character is dead. And your DM is like, sorry, dude, I know you spent a lot of time on that character, but like, we can't just revive him. You're gonna have to create a new character and come back to the caravan a different way, right? And you, who have spent years loving this character and getting to know this character and deciding who this character is going to be and what they do and what's important to them and who they love and all the experiences that they had and just everything that they have been working on and you've been working on for them. And now it's just gone. It's just gone. Like, you feel like, God, that was almost like not a waste, but oh gosh, I was so excited to see what this character was going to do at next week's quest, you know, like just things like that. And that is the most simplistic way that I can explain the grief that I felt for myself of this, like, it didn't feel like it was over for me. It just felt like my character, this being, this meat body was done. And I have never in my life believed in reincarnation until I woke up and remembered exactly what I had said to myself. And again, that feeling of, I knew I had an acceptance because I felt like, okay, on to the next. And I knew I had this feeling that somebody was going to come and get me, and that I just needed to wait here in that place. And I distinctly remember feeling that they were coming from the right side of me, or they were going to. I didn't see anybody. Nobody came. Because then I woke up in the back of the ambulance. They had revived me and I was on the way to the hospital. But I distinctly remember when I went through all of that, feeling like, okay, all right, I know what's going on. Like, I know the drill. I'll wait here. So then when I woke up in the back of the ambulance, it was not, let's just say that was rough, because I went from this place of peace and calm and absolutely no pain, and knowing a feeling of acceptance that what I had been working for was gone, but that more was coming, and a readiness for that and a readiness for the adventure that was coming ahead of me. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait, nope. You're going to go back to this character that you thought was gone, going back to this life. You still got some more work to do there. And also there's going to be a crap ton of pain and you might lose your arm. That was the thing I remember as soon as I woke up in the hospital or in the ambulance. And I remember being like, okay, great. Like, I know that sounds awful. And I know that nobody who loves me would want to hear that, but that was the truth because I was also just, it was just so heavy to be thrust back. That's the best word. I mean, I've used it multiple times before because it's just, that's what it felt like. Just pain, immediate. And so I woke up in the ambulance. I remembered what had happened. I remembered seeing my arm before blacking out. And I asked him, I was like, am I going to keep my arm? You know, of course I'm like drugged up on morphine at this point. And it's bandaged as it's so huge. They've got so much bandaging on it. And I was like, I'm going to keep my arm. And he just looks at me and he makes the, so it was such a grimace, the face that he made. And he was so apologetic. And he was like, I don't know. And that was when I was like, okay, cool. And I passed back out again, because I'm pretty sure the other guy was like, a few morphine, give her more. And so I was like, again, I had this, okay, I'm just going to pass out. And with the acceptance that I'm going to probably wake up without my left arm. and I didn't, luckily the surgeon that worked on my arm was able to keep it. And I have like 98% mobility. He said, had it been a few millimeters off or different, you know, they always say that, I feel like, but he did say it. So I feel obligated to relay. He did say if it was a few millimeters off, it would have severed the main nerve in the arm and it would have been useless. So the fact that I have it, I'm very grateful for. But I spent 2 weeks in the hospital after that. And then I had to move from Nashville, where I was living at the time, back to Mobile, Alabama to live with my family to recover. And because insurance wouldn't pay for rehab. So I went back and lived in my childhood home, and it just, this is delicate. It's a delicate situation because like, I don't mean to talk ill of my family, but there was a lot of expectation. It felt like for me to just go back to being the same old, they have always called me Morgan, my middle name. So to go back to the same old Morgan that I always was. And it was just incredibly difficult for me because I just felt like I couldn't shake this feeling that I should have died. I had incredibly deep suicidal ideation. And I think that stemmed from, luckily nobody else got hurt in the accident. So it wasn't like survivor's guilt in the way that I think it is whenever you lose somebody and you're the one who didn't die. And you're like, why wasn't I the one who died? I should have died. They should be here. It wasn't like that. It was, I was bitter because life is hard. Life is really tough. And I was so unhappy in my life, even though I had said I really liked that one. And I think I loved me. I love myself. I'm proud of who I am. And I will always try to be better and try to be a person that I can be proud of continuously. And that's what I meant by that. But like, I was not in a good place in my life at that point. And I was already searching for a way out. And the accident, luckily, before I realized it, was my out. It was my out. It did save me. But at the time, that also caused me to go back into a home life situation that wasn't exactly beneficial for me. And I had to, unfortunately, come face to face with a lot of trauma that I had dealt with as a child growing up in that house. that I had swept under the rug for my own protection and for my own well-being and mental health, even though it's not good for you. That was my coping mechanism, was I think to just forgive and forgive and forgive and forget as much as we can. And to be an adult and be back in those situations, unfortunately, it took all of those years of me telling myself, gaslighting myself of like, you were just a kid. That's normal. That's like normal behavior for people. And to be an adult and realize, no, that's not normal. That is abusive behavior. And to have to be in a house again and deal with that on top of what I was dealing with, of my own suicidal ideation, of my own being in pain every single day, still worrying if I was going to lose my arm eventually because of all of the, I had to grow back this big, about like a little bigger than a lemon size area of tissue that was just, I had to grow it back and every day deal with the maintenance of this wound. And I mean, it was just so much pain and so much upkeep. And I just felt so completely alone. I got back into theater and that helped me a lot. And I think I would say at one point that actually saved my life, because I was ready to call it quits. And I have been since then multiple times, but I know I won't. I feel confident in that. Because again, I want to make the most of this life. And I feel like that's all I can do by being given the second chance, whether that was intentional or random, I don't care. I have a second chance. And so I'm just going to keep doing what I can do to, like I said, live a life that makes me proud and happy and do well by others. But I don't know. I think that's been the hardest part, is trying to find, how do I do that? And how do I become this person who's proud again, while also dealing with thoughts of suicide? You know, how do I do that?
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question was, you know, I think we have a lot of commonalities when you're talking about, like, you know, how do you deal with, you know, childhood trauma? Well, we have resources, we have programs that are in self with, how do you deal with, you know, PTSD of, you know, war or, you know, other traumatic things that we've experienced? Well, we have resources, we have programs, we have stuff for that. And I feel like something like your story is so unique, to where it's like, okay, someone died and then they came back to life. How do you cope with that? How do you handle that trauma from day in and day out? Because it just seems like there's such a small group of people that fit into that category.
And I, you know, another thing that it's caused, in addition to just the depression and the anxiety, the PTSD, the suicidal ideation, has been these severe bouts of dissociation, where, so after the accident and what I said to myself, and this, I fully believe now that our souls do go on. I don't believe that it has anything to do with religion. I think that everyone moves on in the same way. And I think it's irrespective of, even if you were a good person, I think it's this life and whichever lives we get after, because I do believe in reincarnation, not in a religious sense, but in a way of that our souls come here to live a life and then they move through the soul place, you know, of which, if you haven't any understanding of what I'm talking about, I highly recommend reading Journey of Souls by Michael Newton. That has been one of the most illuminating texts for me. And it's just based on what I experienced, has made the most sense and has linked up beautifully with what I said to myself in those moments. And essentially he uses hypnosis, or did, he's passed away now, but he was using hypnosis to help people regress do soul regression, essentially, to what were your past lives and what was it like in between, like what happens in between these lives. And so I highly recommend Journey of Souls. There's like a couple of books, Destiny of Souls and everything, but Journey of Souls is the first. And that that's kind of what I reference a lot when I say like the soul place. I mean this place where you, whether you call it heaven or you know, however you want to determine it. But I don't think that we just stay there for all eternity. I think that we go there and we learn and we, you know, figure out how we could have done this life better, or what are the things that our soul needs in order to become a higher version of ourselves, and through the next life that we're given, how can we, what are the ways that we can overcome those obstacles? What are the ways that we can be better, do better? And that's kind of our choice though. I think that's made the most sense to what I've experienced. And that's how I've dealt with this. A lot of it is by trying to make sense of it, by trying to read different religious texts and read different, you know, texts on spirituality, on the paranormal, on ghosts, on whatever I can get my hands on that might have a different take that I can read about and understand. And like I said, the one that has made the most sense has been Journey of Souls for me, but that's not going to be the same for everybody. And I don't think it really matters what we believe. So I guess focusing on death, yes, it can be morbid, but for me, it's been an awakening, even more so after the accident.
I mean, you're not alone. I feel like it comes with the territory of not only what you've gone through, but also the target demographic of the content you're creating. You know, I feel that, you know, even the majority of the content that I create, being horror too, like, and being a Christian, I do have this weird fascination with death, because it breaks my brain to know that eternity, whether you look at it in a Christianity sense or any other religion, like, just that breaks my brain. Like, reincarnation, it breaks my brain, like the fact that I am never going to die. Like, just, I don't know how to cope with that.
I know, I get that, and that's totally understandable. And I think that's kind of where the dissociation comes in for me, because there is that we're within that realization, with whatever way that you choose to look at that realization. If you want to take it as, you know, in your religion or in just spiritualism as a period, whichever way you look at it, what that does is it offers you this understanding that while I Shanna am the being that you see before you, as well as that soul that spoke within that void place during my death, right? So even though I can separate those two and understand that I have my higher self, my soul self, and my ego self, my body, this meat brain that I have, that person that deals with chemical imbalances and deals with trauma, they are both one and the same in this person that is Shanna, but they are also separate in that when Shanna dies, when my meat brain is no longer functioning, my soul that is not named Shanna, that has a different name, my soul will continue forward and will take what Shanna has learned and experienced and grown with, you know, those characteristics that Shanna has experienced, learn from those and take those into my next life.
Yeah. And so, like, I guess, like, my last question is, like, you know, as you're kind of going in and out of days, you know, you talk about just, you know, even now still feeling the desire for suicide. What are some ways that, I guess, like, what are some practical steps that you take day in and day out to kind of change your mind away from that mindset?
For me, you know, one of the biggest parts of my practice is gratitude. And so I tell people witchcraft, it doesn't have to be some big, you know, cloak and dagger, light my candles, cast my circle kind of thing. Now, sometimes I love doing that. Absolutely. It's lots of fun. But for me, my daily witchcraft is more along the lines of, you know, when I wake up in the morning and I go to make my coffee, for every spoonful of sugar, I'm going to put an intention into my day. So today I am focused on, you know, gratitude. Today I'm focused on humility. Today I'm focused on activity. Today I'm focused on sending love to my best friend, or whatever my intentions are for the day. And I kind of think about those as I'm stirring my coffee. And then when I drink those intentions in, I try to inform what I'm going to do throughout the day, or when I light my candles. I know it's little things like that, but it's just, it comes down to mindfulness. And I think that's been what I've learned, is especially when we have screens everywhere and we have so many distractions and wonderful ways to meet new people and distract ourselves and cope, you have to be aware of where your mind is. And so that's something I do say to people who love horror, like myself: make sure that you're allowing time for reprieve and for mindfulness and for ways that, if horror isn't getting yourself into a positive mindset, which for me, though it is cathartic, it's not exactly putting me in a positive mindset. So I do try to make time to really every single day try to ask myself, you know, have I been mindful today? Have I allowed myself moments to just reflect on my feelings today? How am I feeling? And allow myself space to feel those feelings, not just look at them intellectually and say, okay, that's a feeling I'm having, and now it's going back under the drawer, you know, but actually let myself feel them. And so, for example, yesterday, I'm getting over being sick. And yesterday I woke up and I just was having a really dark day. And so I looked at my partner and I just was like, I'm, first of all, very grateful that I can communicate this with you and that I know it's a safe space, but I'm really depressed today. And I really just want to stay in bed and order a pizza and watch The Office. And he was like, absolutely. Is there anything else that you need? I'm here for you. And there's nowhere else I'd rather be. Let's do this. Let's have a great day. And it was great. And it was exactly what I needed. And that was what I mean by giving myself the time to say, okay, what am I feeling? And honoring myself enough to allow myself to just feel that, and giving myself a safe space in which to do that. Because, you know, I'm lucky enough to work for myself to where I can take a day like I did yesterday and just give myself that space. If you're not lucky enough to be able to do that in the same way, try to find a way that you can. Like for me, when I had to work, it, you know, for another company, I was theater. Theater was my safe place to just get feelings out, or music, or whatever it is. But I just think that's so important. Give yourself an outlet for positive energy exchange outside of horror, outside of, you know, video games, but a way for you that fills you with good and positive energies.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We talked about this in our infrared review, but there has to be enough about you knowing not only your own mental health boundaries, but also like establishing them for like with other people, like those safe yes. spaces, like you're talking about with your partner. Like there are definite days where we're recording this early July. But I like all last week, like was just like, I need to step away from social media and just not be on here. And I just dove into the world of David Lynch for 5 days and then came back out. It was very weird and chaotic, but, you know, I have such a coming back to like social media, coming back to the world. Like it is a refreshing experience because, you know, like you said, we live through our screens now. And so the ability to kind of step back and understand and know your boundaries on where you need to hit pause for your own mental health. Like some days mm-hmm. you just need pizza and office days.
You know? Yeah.
and that's the thing that I love specifically about, about being a cinephile is being that I love horror, but I'm a cinephile first. and horror might be my favorite genre, but I know those days where like I'm not in the best headspace, so I'm gonna throw on Mean Girls, or I'm gonna throw on Step Brothers, and
I think that's just as much. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you're fine.
I got excited. I think that's just as much a part of self-care as, you know, as is taking the time to, you know, make sure you shower and feed yourself properly. Like do that. Take just a second to look inward and ask yourself, am I in a headspace for this conversation right now? Am I in the good headspace for this particular type of media? Is the social media that I'm engaging with today like draining me? And noticing those things will give you so much more freedom and power over your own emotions and your own headspace and when you change those things.
Absolutely. And so I think that's going to conclude it for us this episode. This has been a really solid episode. But one more time, thank you so much for being vulnerable, because I know that stories like this are always hard to tell, but I feel like they're really encouraging to come out on the other side of them.
Thank you so much for having me and for creating the safe space to allow me to feel vulnerable like that. I appreciate it.
Well, absolutely. Always. Hit us one more time with the social links or with where people can find you and follow you online.
So if you want to just Google Linktree and The Ghoulish Gal, that's going to be my Linktree. Or you can do The Ghoulish Garb Linktree. Either way, you'll find our stuff. But you can also find me on TikTok at the_ghoulish_gal. All of my links will be there as well.
You guys can follow me also. I'm on Letterboxd at Captain Nostalgia. You guys can follow me on TikTok as well. It's Gent, G-E-N-T, Ghostface. I do the occasional horror. I don't know. I'm not as active as Shanna. So, you know, it's a surprise when I'm going to be on there. You guys can follow our parent company, Victims and Villains. We're all on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, Patreon, YouTube, and wherever you guys get your podcasts from. You guys can find all those links in the show notes below, along with more podcasts like this, movie reviews, ways to support us financially, and also as well, you guys can also, most importantly, check out our mental health resource library. This is the reason why we create the content we do, is to have conversations like this and to remind you that you are not alone. So until next time, remember, stay classy, San Diego.